Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Chiverton and your co-host today is Ada Wong. Ada, good morning to you.
Good morning, Hugh.
Today we're talking about a five-year plan. The Deputy Director of the Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office, Huang Li-Chuan, said yesterday that China's dream of rejuvenating the nation also includes the dream of 7.5 million Hong Kong people. In a seminar on the national 14th five-year plan, he reiterated the SAR is an inalienable part of China and the national blueprint underpins the territory's financial, trading, aviation, technology, legal and cultural sectors. It will improve their competitiveness and enable them to merge into the country's overall development, he said. Central government officials have also, for the first time, briefed lawmakers on national policies at LegCo, saying the city had already wasted a lot of time during the 2019 anti-government protests. What do we expect then from the plan? How will Hong Kong be included? What impact will it bring to our economy? What about the cultural elements? What sort of cultural exchange does it mandate for us? Let us know your thoughts, your questions and your comments. You can leave a message on our Facebook page. That's Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. Or you can email us with your questions and thoughts. That's backchat@rthk.hk. Or you can call us. And our number is 233-88266. That's 233-88266. Joining us for our discussion, we have with us now Whitman Hung, who's a NPC deputy and also principal liaison officer for Hong Kong at the Shenzhen Shanghai Authority. Mark Michelson is with us, chairman of the Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia, and David Webb, founder and editor of website.com, a shareholder activist. Once again, our email is backchat@rthk.hk. We've got a few emails on other topics. Maybe we'll get to those in a little bit, mostly kind of related to COVID things. Whitman Hung, Mr. Hung, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us once again. What do you think are the main points? What would you say was the headline from this talks, from these seminars?
Well, I think, first of all, I think you need to increase the awareness of Hong Kong people on the 14th five-year plan. Actually, I myself attended the NPC session and then I did study the overall plan. And it's, you know, not only are those two chapters that are highly related to Hong Kong, but we also need to understand how China is developing and how Hong Kong can, I want to use the word merge, I think it's more like economic integration. And, you know, and that is important, especially the dual circulation. I think that it means a lot to the traditional way we do business in Hong Kong, because we used to be only the international circulation, right? But the domestic market is growing up. There's a lot of Hong Kong manufacturers in China, but in the past place, they were all selling to North America and Europe. But now, if you want to sell to the local market, you may need to change. You need to change your design, your packaging, your standards. Instead of CE, you may need to use the national Chinese standard. You know, things like that. We need to pay attention to that. At the same time, I think this new positioning of the arts and cultural exchange for Hong Kong, I think that is also some very important, you know. If I recall, I've never heard any national leaders talk about this before, or any other documents that talk about this before. So, but arts and culture is always here in Hong Kong, as Ada can tell. But so at this time, it's on a national strategy positioning, and I think that is important to Hong Kong as well.
Whitman, you pointed out that there will be differences in the future in how, let's say, businessmen do things. But let's tackle this economic integration concept that you just mentioned. How would this be different from what we see now in terms of like investment, in terms of maybe producing products for the domestic market, for the national domestic markets?
Yeah. Well, if you remember when China first opened up, the Hong Kong investment inside is always manufacturing, but they're leveraging the low labor costs and land costs and then selling outside. So there's not, in fact, in the early days, you were not even allowed to sell to the local market. You need a special permit to do domestic retailing. So, so that's for the way we, well, there was still integration, but at that time, integration is more about, you know, how to comply with the laws and how to enjoy the tax cuts and benefits. But now you're dealing with the local market. And in fact, China is not one large market. It's hundreds of, you know, large local markets, and you need to learn about it. You need to understand the consumer behavior, how to do branding. At the same time, I think another thing that's important is China is also moving from a high-speed growth to what they call a high-quality growth. So the consumers has higher standards. They want better things. They want better branding. And Hong Kong can play a role there. You know, we can help to upgrade, for example, the traditional Chinese product into more like, well, I would say name brands, probably not the right word, but, you know, higher brand value stuff, higher quality. And I think that's Hong Kong, you know, one of the strengths of Hong Kong is we do things like product design, branding, advertisement. But in the past, it was more aiming at the international market. But now maybe we need to, you know, also include, we still need to do the international market, which is very important also for Chinese enterprises going abroad. And when we see integration, it doesn't mean Hong Kong follow China. It means what we do is what we do should also meet with their needs and their demand and match with the market needs there. So it's not only the consumer market which we're selling inside, but also helping, for example, companies like Huawei and DJI, I mean, the smaller version of those, go into the international market through Hong Kong.
Is it your impression that China is slightly kind of turning inwards, that the domestic market?
Not really. I think this is something a lot of discussion is in academia as well. Because it was last year, I think, during the MPC, when Xi Jinping talked about the domestic market, and all of a sudden everybody's talking about domestic market. They're very, you know, and very soon the Central Committee issued some papers and saying, well, no, it's due to circulation. It's not just the domestic market. Of course, China is a very large market that, you know, that will attract talents, investment, as well as products. But at the same time, they want to open up. So, but the open up is a little bit different maybe from the... I was reading this article by Zhen Yongyan. You know, he was talking about we should unilaterally open up of China, you know, instead of, you know, in the past, it's probably like forced by WTO or the US or whatever. But now it's like, okay, we want to open up no matter what, because opening up is good for China to create more competition, to raise the value and compare them with the local enterprises. So I really don't think China is going inward. But the way they open up is a little bit different. A, they raise the bar. For example, financial market, they say, okay, we're going to, you know, allow foreign finance companies to come in, but they raise the overall bar for anybody to open a new bank in China. So, short answer is obviously, no, it's not going inward, but it also want to demonstrate to the world we have a large domestic market and we welcome you to come. Remember, they have this import, this show in Shanghai, right? In the old days, or in fact, any countries in the world, it's also about export, right? But only in China, they actually organize a very large conference in Shanghai every year for imports. And that is, you know, unseen of if you can look at all the other economies.
Right. Mark Michelson, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. What do you make of this visit and Hong Kong's role in the five-year plan?
Well, you know, I think it's setting a goal, and it's setting a standard, and sort of saying Japanese would say "gambatte," try hard and do your best to fit into the program. A lot of it isn't new. Some things are a little bit new. More emphasis on not only the traditional areas of strength of Hong Kong, like financial services and as a renminbi center and so on, but also as innovation technology hub, which we've heard a lot about. Not much has been done so far, but there's a lot of talk about it, a lot of money thrown in its direction. And aviation hub, which would be interesting, assuming we ever get back to aviation again, which we all hope will happen someday. So in that sense, it's good. There are some barriers, I think. And for example, you know, first, it's one country, two systems. So we're still, at this point, different to some extent than the rest of China. But traditionally, the governments of Hong Kong, and especially the city of Guangzhou, and sometimes the province, haven't always worked together very well. And this is sort of an important part of the process. That has to help. We still have a hard border. And that border's gotten harder because of COVID, as you've seen. I know that's a major topic of your discussions as well. And that's important. And both businesses and people, I think, have to be convinced that this is going to be advantageous for them as well. And that includes young people who are encouraged to go to the GBA, for example, and work, and there are opportunities there, but many of them so far have been reluctant to do so for various reasons, and that's an important part of the equation as well. Just one comment on dual circulation. David will probably go into more detail on this. Yeah, it's also a reflection, I think, of not only the importance of China's domestic economy, and international firms are increasingly moving to a in-China, for-China strategy, what I sometimes call one company, two systems, sometimes more than two systems, looking at China specifically and looking at those areas. But also, it's a reflection of the changes in globalization and the pushback to globalization as well, and looking for alternatives to that, depending more and more on the domestic market in areas like supply chains and semiconductors and so on.
So how would this new five-year plan, impact the sort of business strategies of multinationals in Hong Kong?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of it will center, many of them are looking at the GBA and seeing if there are opportunities there and how that fits into the program. But, international firms, most of them that are operating in China, always are looking to align with national plans, economic plans, especially the five-year plan. They're always trying to do that with mixed results sometimes. And Hong Kong would fit into that equation. Those that are based in Hong Kong or want to use Hong Kong as a way of entering that and finding what advantages they can use, especially in areas like professional services, for example, which is an area where Hong Kong excels in. And, the idea also of doing that in China and as well as Hong Kong, it's where the red lines are, where the border lines are in between that, because that's one of Hong Kong's big advantages at this point, differentiation areas.
What about the sort of ideological difference between a centrally planned economy, like this five-year plan, and the laissez-faire that we've had in the past in Hong Kong? Are they compatible? Or are we just going to stop doing that now?
Well, I think David will comment on this, too. I think we've been moving away from that, from positive non-interventionism for a long time, and I think this just reinforces it. The problem with that, and this includes the U.S. is trying to move toward toward this kind of policy as well, industrial policy, governments, for the most part, aren't very good at it. China a little bit more because they have more experience, but Hong Kong doesn't have a lot of experience, and when we've tried, it's been, to say the least, mixed results and sometimes not very good ones. So I think we're moving in that direction. I expect there'll be a lot of cooperation with mainland authorities and getting guidance in that area as well.
Because when we get when it's something like the five-year plan says, support Hong Kong to enhance its status as a international aviation hub.
Right.
So do we go and what do? We build another airport? We build another runway?
Well, there are vast plans for the airport. They're in the midst of it now, expanding anyway, and to make it much more expanded and diversified operation right now. So I suppose that's going in that direction. Again, there are a lot of uncertainties right now, necessarily related to the five-year plan.
Mm. David Webb, good morning to you.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us once again. Your thoughts, first of all, in general, on the five-year plan, what it means for Hong Kong?
First thought is it's got the wrong name. It should be the four-year, four-month plan, because that's how long it's got left. It's already 8 months old. Not sure why we're only talking about it now instead of before it started during last year. Secondly, we can't do very much with our borders hermetically sealed, even with the boundary with the mainland hermetically sealed, even though our infection rate is now lower, being zero, than theirs. That just reminds us all of the separation between the systems, which is promised in the basic law, the one country, two systems model. Separate law, separate currency, separate customs and excise, separate taxation regimes, separate immigration regimes, and the same for Macau, actually, as well. All this talk of integration, of course, economically, it has been going on since the opening up began in 1979, and it's a bit rich to be lectured on lost time by a government that wasted 30 years after 1949 hammering its economy into the ground before it started opening up, and has lost time since then when it could have opened up much faster on capital controls, for example. I thought this would have happened 15 to 20 years ago, soon after the entrance to WTO, which, by the way, Whitman, it wasn't a forced entry. No one forced China to join the WTO. In fact, China wanted to join and got very favourable conditions for joining. But it took a long time to honour those conditions in terms of foreign investment permissions, which still aren't fully there. And you asked, why is it that China has dedicated import fares when other countries don't? Well, maybe it's because it's so difficult otherwise to get your goods and services into China without the official approval that comes with appearing in a fair probably organized by a state-run entity. If the government would get out of the way and do less central planning, that has been the key to the huge improvement in people's livelihoods in the mainland since 1979. It's not doing more central planning, it's doing less of it. Farmers can now choose which crops to grow, who to sell them to, and what price they get. Factories don't have quotas of production. Graduates aren't told where they're going to be working, and they can choose their employers. The economy is a lot freer than it was, but that process of opening up stagnated about 20 years ago. The government still has control over huge portions of the old economy, such as airlines, steel, telecommunications, they have no sign of taking the next step of relinquishing that control.
Let me put it like this: do you think Hong Kong would be better off in economic terms if we went along with the 5-year plan and integrated and took a part in the nation as a whole?
Hong Kong people are a very clever lot, and they will exploit whatever framework is put in front of them.
Good, yeah, that's good, though, isn't it?
And so that means, if you like, playing along. Mark talked about alignment with the central planning. Basically, if the government says certain things are a priority and we're going to subsidise them, then of course people will line up and take the subsidies and do what's and that will alter their behaviours.
So we can get richer and join the 5-year plan.
But it wouldn't be as optimal as if the governments here and in the mainland simply stepped aside and let people get on with optimal allocation of capital and labour and other resources. So, if you look at the sort of summaries that I've seen in English of the 5-year plan, there's all sorts of talk about blockchain and Belt and Road and DNA and other things. Well, sure, big data is another buzzword that keeps popping up. It's like reading the policy address, really. It's not very different. Really, we should just let the market decide where the money should be allocated, rather than taxing higher rates, which Hong Kong will soon have to do if it's going to keep up this level of state expenditure on things like Lok Ma Chau Loop and infrastructure and also want on handouts rather than welfare.
All right, Mr. Hung?
Well, I mean, this will be an endless debate between, you know, planet economy and market economy. China is a market economy in a socialist sense. So it's opening up. It's freer, but it's not absolutely free. And I think personally, I mean, in academia, we also talk about that as well. You know, there's no such things as a free, you know, a perfect market. Market fails. And in areas such as deep technology investment, even the U.S. government subsidizing, they're investing in technology development. So is Singapore, so is Malaysia, you know, all these places. So I think the only problem is, of course, it's English translation, because the 5-year plan actually changed its names. If you remember, Ada, in the old time, it's really planning, like detailed planning. Now it's more like a framework. So it's not really the detailed planning of the quota production, things like that. But it's more about the overall directions. Where should the government invest? Where would they pay attention? For example, pollution, right? They talk about pollution in the past 10 years, a lot of things. And, of course, there are subsidies. But these are subsidies for good. You know, if you look at, you want to correct the market, you have to do something. Otherwise, the market will say, okay, well, never mind, this external cost. I'll do whatever I want and let the pollution goes on. Right? So the government say, okay, yeah, so here's a law and here's a subsidy. If you do something to clean the water, I'll give you some money. Okay.
Well, that's you've got to distinguish between intervention and capturing the externalities. I mean, should there be a carbon tax or some such? In my view, yes, because it shouldn't be free to pollute the air and kill the planet. You know, there ought to be that kind of government and indeed not just governmental, but international treaty imposed obligations, because otherwise you end up with free riders.
Yeah, but it's not just externality. So, we always talk about monopolization, for example. I mean, an absolutely free market economy will at the end arrive and monopolize.
That's why we have
antitrust, right?
Antitrust and competition.
And that's
laws.
Government intervention.
And that ensures a level playing field. And there have been antitrust actions, for example, recently against Alibaba for telling merchants that they cannot sell through other parties if they sell through Alibaba. They got fined for that. And I'm in support of that kind of measure to make sure that the economy functions competitively. But then there's the kind of state shakedown that seems to be going on when Tencent the other day promises to donate 100 billion RMB. That's like an entire year's profit to reduce wealth disparities. Now, it's not their job to reduce wealth disparities at the expense of their shareholders. It is their job to pay their fair taxes. And if they have somehow found tax loopholes, it's the government's job to close the tax loopholes. But they did pay 20 billion RMB in taxes last year. And so if the government's concerned about companies being too successful without abusing a monopoly, then they should just raise the tax rate.
Is this a bit of a kind of ideological discussion?
No, it's not really ideological
at
all.
For Hong Kong people, surely, we've got an enormous market on our doorstep, and the five-year plan is just a way to get access.
Yeah, but I don't think there's an ongoing debate about whether communism or central planning works. It doesn't, Whitman. I mean, it's been tried and tested in China until 1979.
Yeah, but so is the free economy being tested in the United States, and look at where it's heading to.
Properly structured free markets work. When governments intervene and set up things like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they don't work. That's what triggered the housing crisis.
I'll tell you, David Webb, because you're going to stay on, and I think Whitman Hung will be leaving at 9 o'clock, so
you'll
get free reign after that. But Whitman Hung, just before you go, I wanted to just question about you mentioned the cultural aspects. I think if you look at the five-year plan, some of the sort of contrasts between the two systems are most stark to me, because culture for the five-year plan is about Marxism. Marxism guides all activities in our ideological space.
Well, ideological, yes.
How do we fit in
culture
that?
Culture is a different thing. And that's one other observation I had. You know, in the whole 14th five-year plan, culture was mentioned 51 times. Innovation was 49.
Socialist cultural 51. Development
development?
Every word in this plan had been carefully crafted. So if they mention culture 51 times, they only mention innovation 49 and reform 47, that means they're paying a lot of attention on culture. Culture is not just about the livelihood, but also about businesses as well. They're putting, you know, the cultural industry, they also mention. I mean, that's to Hong Kong. I think that's something that's interesting.
We have common interest in economic terms because money is money. But if they're talking about socialist culture, that's not what we want in Hong Kong, is it?
No.
Chinese Constitution says that capitalism is decadent. How do we reconcile with that?
Well, first of all, we have one country, two systems. So Hong Kong, very clearly, we have a capitalist system. Secondly, I think culture is more than just about ideological things. We're talking about, Ada can tell much better than this, but, you know, culture is very wide. It's not just about, you know, paintings and collections. I mean, one of the things, from what I heard from my government Hong Kong friends, is they're looking at all these auctions. I mean, that's creating economic value to Hong Kong, obviously.
Okay. Well, we've got to go break for the news now at 9 o'clock. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Whitman Hung, we're going to stay, and also a culture expert is going to be joining us after the news at 9. Stick around. The weather, sunny periods and one or two showers forecast for today. Temperatures up to about 32 degrees. And the outlook, sunny periods and a few showers tomorrow, very hot. On Thursday, 30 Celsius at the moment with the relative humidity now at 80%. Welcome back. This is Bank Chat on a Tuesday morning with Ada Wong and me, Hugh Chiverton. We're talking about the five-year plan following that visit yesterday, the speeches and the seminars given by officials from the Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office. We were talking to MPC Deputy Whitman Hung in the first part of the program. Still with us now is Mark Michelson, Chairman of Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia, and David Webb, shareholder activist, founder and editor of website.com. We're also joined now by Helen So, who's the lead of arts and culture at the Our Hong Kong Foundation. We want to hear from you. You can email backchat at rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page as well. That's Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. Or call us. And our number is 233-88266, and we'll put you on air. Just before we get back to the topic, some emails related to our discussion yesterday about vaccination policy and quarantine and so on. Let's see. Andrew Kay says, so yesterday Andrew Kay sent a message saying, saying with regard to Nicole Kidman, who is this person? Is she famous? I said yes. Andrew Kay says, your answer was just stupid, meaning you missed my point entirely. She, famous or not, contributes nothing to Hong Kong, and the Hong Kong government helps nobody by allowing her to bypass the quarantine rules, and they should not have allowed her entry without quarantine. JK says, I sort of mangled an email from him yesterday. He's amended it, and so this is JK's message. Dear Backchat, signals versus noise. JK says, the vaccine hesitant folks are finding it difficult to differentiate signals from noises. Signal, a red light at a pedestrian crossing, whether there are cars passing or not, is a signal not to cross. Noises, you're at a crossing and it's a red light, but your friends suggest you cross it because you're late for lunch. Do you ignore the signal, accept your friend's noise as a signal to cross? If at that moment you are dithering on whether to cross, a crowd rushes up behind you and you hear a noise. Run, a man coming to shoot us. Do you accept the noises you are hearing are signals to cross? Voices like legislators like Michael Tin, who lobbies for his constituents, make signals versus noise differentiation more challenging for the lay public. Accepted that the doctor gave a signal, though not necessarily a good one, he'd probably not do his homework. Nevertheless, Professor Malik gives a clear counter-signal that just having allergies to multiple drugs is not a clear contraindication and the consequences are manageable. The doctor has not assessed fully the consequences of COVID, however low the risks of catching it are significant, i.e. life-threatening, especially with his elderly patients who may have significant comorbidity. And the consequences of vaccination, BioNTech, is low and not significant. By the way, the reason for the waiting list is allergy testing until 2024. Is due to this particular panic whereby many are going to tests. Not all GP or family medicine doctors do not want to take any responsibility and update their knowledge and pass the buck to the system. Get a test. That is from JK. And finally, Alonso says, yesterday's announcement by the US FDA that it has granted full approval to the BioNTech vaccine prompted a number of American municipalities, US government agencies such as the Pentagon and a slew of large corporations to announce vaccine mandates for their workers. For example, New York City yesterday said that if all the city's school staff have to be fully vaccinated over the next month, can Hong Kong's private sector employers and the government issue similar mandates? Do Hong Kong employment laws allow for this? If so, it would certainly boost our vaccination rate. If any listeners can spare any expert insights into the legal situation, I would be most grateful. That's from Alonso. Many thanks. Backchat at rthk.hk. Email address. Helen So, good morning to you.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
So there is a mention of a cultural exchange and promoting Hong Kong's role in developing itself into a centre for cultural and art exchanges with other countries in the 5-year plan. What does that mean? what sort of practice and what sort of projects might come under that?
Actually, very much since, you know, the initial announcement of the 14th five-year plan, I've observed that there's been quite a lot of talk in the arts and cultural scene about, you know, what's been said there, you know, the exact premise of this new positioning, what it means, because actually, you know, like you said, it raises for the very first time, actually, the mandate to develop Hong Kong into, quote-unquote, you know, a hub of arts and cultural exchanges between China and the rest of the world. So I feel that has really sparked copious discussions within the cultural industry, people trying to figure out what it means. And, I mean, like, my take on it, and actually, if you speak to people in the industry, and as well as, you know, cultural policymakers, they will tell you, and actually we know that Hong Kong has been doing cultural exchange and been a hub of cultural exchange for many years already. Like, you know, when we think of cultural exchange, perhaps we already have images of, you know, Hong Kong Art Basel, you know, Hong Kong Art Festival, Film Art, Book Fair, you know, all these mega cultural events, they just pop up in your mind, like, instantly. And, you know, obviously the government has funding schemes. They've recently opened, you know, the National Arts Fund, open for local artists to apply to. And also, I mean, the government even has, you know, a cultural exchange office, for example, that facilitates local artists to tour in mainland as well as other countries around the world. So actually, you know, we can't say that the government hasn't done its fair bit on this form of cultural exchange. So, yes, the point is cultural exchange is not something new to Hong Kong, but what I guess I would like to highlight and to kind of tease out from the national plan, I think the new positioning for Hong Kong in the plan this year, as we've noted, is that it comes at a very good time for us to really, like, you know, reconsider the other potentials of what cultural exchange now can mean to everyone. Obviously, we're in the 21st century, you know, an era of digital culture and an era, you know, post-pandemic era. So, and as a cultural policymaker, obviously, my job is to keep up to date with, you know, different cultural policies around the world and, you know, keeping up to date with cultural trends. And I've got to, you know, my observation is everyone, including the mainland, and perhaps even particularly the mainland, they've moved on from the idea that cultural exchange is only confined to physical events. So people are talking about exchanging cultural IP, intellectual property, and other forms, digital forms of cultural exchange. And of course, here in Hong Kong, we still hear in the speeches of, you know, the most senior government officials, including, you know, the chief executive, they were still, you know, talking about physical events. They cite, you know, museum exhibitions as examples, art tours, festivals. But though, of course, I'm saying that physical events remain indispensable, but I mean they are no longer, you know, the be-all and end-all of cultural exchange. So I guess, even though there is mention for this exciting new role in the realms of culture, the realms of culture for Hong Kong, we would need to readjust.
So what kind of cultural exchange are you thinking of then?
Sorry?
What do you mean?
So the mainland, for example, they're looking at developing arts and culture in a very industry approach. It's very much an industry way of developing arts and culture, as opposed to Hong Kong. I think we're still
centrally planned art.
Sorry, is that David Webb?
Is that it? So centrally planned art, is that it? With you know, vetting committees and making sure that the public only sees what the state wants them to see. That sort of thing, and quotas on movie licenses, and limits on books that you can buy, and filters on the internet so you can't see social culture developing on, you know, social media platforms, that sort of thing.
That's not all. No, definitely not, because I think Hong Kong, we've always been quite an international, you know, place where cultural happenings.
Yes, I'm talking about the mainland. I mean, the mainland approach is diametrically opposed to many of its controls over what people can see and hear. So how do you square that with their stated desire to be more, to have more cultural? I mean, I think culture sometimes is a sort of euphemism for ideology, isn't it, in the mainland? They want the mainland culture to be spread through the Hong Kong school system, you know, supplanting liberal studies with national studies and things like that.
I think, well, yeah, we can see that, you know, obviously Hong Kong operates in a different system and has always been hosting, you know, international arts and culture exhibitions. And I guess just to this is not a direct response to your to your statement, but I guess to give an example, for example, you know, we all know that, you know, the Hong Kong Palace Museum will be ready, will be open next year. But I guess the point is, you know, we don't need a replica of the Beijing Palace Museum in Hong Kong. So that's not kind of we're not trying to be a replica of the Beijing Palace Museum in Hong Kong. So the point is to have, you know, a separate Hong Kong branded institution in Hong Kong.
I mean, the problem with that is that a lot of the national treasure is in Taipei, isn't it? So, so really, you need to be borrowing stuff from the National Museum in Taipei, but they won't lend it to us because then it'll be confiscated back to the mainland, probably. They consider it stolen. So we can't have that here. We can only have the stuff that remains in Beijing on loan to the Hong Kong branch.
Helen, I wonder, you know, focus as one Hong Kong people can do, you know, with this new positioning that the nation, you know, wants Hong Kong to be. So say you are a young person in Hong Kong. What would this mean to you? And not everybody wants to, you know, to be involved in arts trading. So, and you have talked about arts and digital culture. And I guess in the eyes of the whole country, perhaps culture might be more economic, more like a cultural business than, say, you know, understanding our local heritage and really arts for art's sake, or, you know, just be able to do arts education and that sort of thing. How do you see, you know, what are the opportunities for young people and what sort of skill sets do they need?
Yeah, thank you, Ada. I definitely think there is actually quite a lot of room and quite a lot of scope for new ideas and new skill sets in the realms of arts and culture in Hong Kong. We've been looking at the idea of, you know, arts and technology for quite some time in the foundation, and we've noticed that, you know, the area of art tech, obviously accelerated by COVID, it's really caught on as something that might be a new option for young creatives in Hong Kong to kind of, try out different things. There's more possibilities for art making and creativity. And actually, art tech, as, you know, a new emerging industry, it brings in a lot of different opportunities for Hong Kong as well. I think there are more people, you know, obviously, with, you know, the kind of digital media is now something that young people, they live with, they know how to operate, they you know, it's something that is so familiar to them. So and I think, like, the whole area of art tech is probably one avenue or one kind of area where young people can really like dive into and you know, open new businesses, you know, new kind of ideas. I mean, even collaborate with people from different industries, like the technology industry, for example, for new kind of synergies and form kind of new projects.
And should we be spending taxpayers' money on subsidizing that, or should we let people make their own way and choose? If they think they can make a living out of their creativity, then great. They can sell their art tech online, or they can sell their physical art in galleries or by mail. Or should the government take your money and pay people to create art that people aren't willing to pay for?
I think you would need some sort of government subsidy to begin with. But at the same time, I very much agree with you.
So where does it end? If you encourage people to go down that road and say, you know, have a life as an artist, don't worry, we'll pay for you, and then you suddenly cut it off, it's rather
David, we have
hard.
A science park, we have Cyberport.
Exactly, that's the problem.
The government is subsidising quite
a
lot.
And I object to those too.
We have not had a park for culture or for cultural entrepreneurship yet.
Well, two wrongs don't make a right, Ada. So, you know, I'm opposed to the Lok Ma Chau loop and other kinds of government intervention in the economy because, you know, if people have a great idea in Hong Kong, history proves that they're able to exploit it on their own. The fear of paying 16.5% profits tax has never stopped them from doing that. They don't need R&D deductions. They don't need free land. You know, if the land is too expensive here, they'll find somewhere else to do it. But the point is we should optimize the use of our scarce resources and not allocate, building another land to another cyberport, which they're doing. They're building a baby cyberport next to the current one. It's a sort of baby white elephant with our money. Why should we be doing that rather than letting the economy run its course and finding the optimal level of artistry, creativity and technology in our economy?
Okay, some comments on our Facebook page. This is from Henry, who says, Hong Kong's lost two or more years in the riots and needs to roll up its sleeve and get down to real hard work. The speakers have mentioned countless opportunities, and Hong Kong different sectors must think about those opportunities and see how they could contribute and through that co-prosper. The plan is nothing new. Perhaps the English press has not covered much, or expat mindset about China makes them somewhat antagonistic towards China. I think Tao Kung Pao and Wen Wei Po needs to have an English version. JFK words apply
it's
here.
It's called China Daily.
Yeah. JFK's words apply here. Ask not what the country would do for you, but what you could do for the country. Only through doing that one finds the way. Mainland has advanced all the way by crossing the river by feeling the stones. Wu Ling said, even if you go slow, you are falling behind already. Since it is a national plan, we must also think along national lines. Officials said Hong Kong's mindset, thinking must mesh seamlessly. Forget about politics, work on development. The quote, no boat ride after Suzhou, by one of the officials is a warning. Once opportunities are lost, they are forever lost. Already Foshan, Nansha, etc. are marching like mad. Backchat should have more deep and detailed sessions on China, on Hong Kong, etc. Superficial discussion won't help. Don't waste time on petty, politically tainted comments. Notice the very high-level delegations signifying the extreme importance. And Henry also says the program anchor, that's me, has outdated view on saying capitalism is decadent, Marxism, etc. China is prospering on mixed economy. Deng Xiaoping had said getting rich is glorious. Besides, CCP uses Marxism progressively. The Marxism dialectical materialism is used extensively in China, and the achievements of China shows Marxism is good. Editors should have updated views and not outdated, biased views. Perhaps RTHK should consider replacing the current editor. That's from Henry. Capitalism is decadent is in the Constitution, Henry. Marxism, I mentioned Marxism. That's kind of the point. Helen So, this is from the five-year plan, introducing socialist cultural development and China's soft power, the chapter on that. It says Marxism guides all activities in our ideological space, reflecting confidence in our culture. Cultural development informed by our core socialist values promotes moral ideas, forges cohesion, helps the younger generation grow and thrive, enriches tradition and shapes our national image. It helps meet the people's cultural need and provides emotional support. It is therefore essential to enhance socialist cultural development. You know, that kind of approach, that kind of rhetoric sounds kind of alien, frankly, to a lot of artists and a lot of cultural workers in Hong Kong. Do you recognize that kind of gap?
Yes, because, you know, we've been operating in a different system for years. And I definitely think, you know, I don't think we're trying to. There is a gap, obviously, with you know what you just mentioned. It is going to be. It is not something that is familiar to you know local creators and the younger generation, young people in Hong Kong. But what I do see as it has been outlined in the national plan is that the government should perhaps, you know, be removing these kind of barriers and actually carving out, you know, what I see is more kind of possibilities and maybe more options for young artists to think about, you know, to explore new ways of creating art and creativity. And so I tend to be a bit more kind of to think of this a bit more positively.
The 5-year plan says we will strengthen efforts to carry out education in Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era and improve the work system of arming the whole party and educating people with the party's innovation theory. We will establish and improve the system and long-term mechanism of remaining true to our original intention and keeping our mission firmly in mind. Strengthen and improve our ideological and political work. Continue the publicity and education on socialism with Chinese characteristics and the Chinese dream. Intensify education on the history of the party, the history of New China, the history of reform of socialing up, and the history of socialist China. Are we going to do that? Is that what we're going to do in Hong Kong?
Is this in chapter 63?
This is chapter 34. This is part 10, socialist cultural development and China's soft power.
I looked at, you know, I've been studying kind of the extracting the bits, you know, that for as Hong Kong to develop into a cultural exchange hub, and under that parameter, I would I do think that there are kind of many possibilities and opportunities for us to kind of really show our strength as an international kind of cultural hub, considering that we've got, you know, a successful and strong legacy with organising events and kind of our strong cinematic.
What we're good at here is trading. So we have zero import duties, zero export duties. So far, at least in private exhibitions, you can show pretty much you want. It's not quite clear whether all of Ai Weiwei's exhibits will make it into the West Kowloon cultural desert or disaster, or whatever you want to call it. So far, we're quite good at running auctions and trading. So maybe we should just focus on being literally an exchange of art for value in Hong Kong.
So, David, you want to reduce art creations, inspiring artworks, trading?
We will have a certain amount of indigenous artistry as well, but we're a small population relative to the world, and we could be trading all of Asia's art in Hong Kong, having safe custody of it for the more valuable pieces, for example, where people are nervous about holding it in unstable political areas of Asia. They might want to have climate-controlled warehouses for their art at the airport or nearby, and have active trade in it. And that's what happened with wine, by the way. Once we abolished wine duty, we became a wine hub. We don't consume much more wine than we did before.
But you're just treating culture as another commodity, literally, aren't you? I mean, it's just...
That's what we're good at. Yeah. You're asking what Hong Kong should be doing.
Yeah, Mark Michelson, go on.
I was just going to say the same climate-controlled storage facilities for wine are also used for art. I mean, temperature is a little bit different, but they are even now.
But the culture surely should be about content. It's not about the...
Of course it should be.
Yeah, it's not about the physical objects.
But I'm just saying. Mark
Michelson, if you cultural exchange, if it talks about making Hong Kong a hub for cultural exchange, what would that mean to you?
I think some of the ideas are great, but, you know, I also would feel more comfortable with Hong Kong driving that, with, of course, support from the government, but not the government being sort of the ones that sort of determine what areas we're going in. And there are a lot of, you know, talk about youth arts. There's a youth arts festival. There are many other groups that are doing that. And maybe they can use some help and they can use some encouragement. But, you know, I also like to see Hong Kong driving that themselves with encouragement, but not with the being overseen and how they do that.
I think they've even set up an apartment block in West Kowloon, or they're going to, with subsidized rents for artists. So you have to sort of prove that you're doing state-approved artistry in West Kowloon, and then you get an apartment in the art hub or whatever it's going to be called. And so that's not really where we want to be going in terms of trying to put everybody in one spot rather than allow them to live where they like and compete for resources.
Helen, so, you know, finally, is this about enhancing China's soft power? Is that an aspect of what we're talking about when we're talking about cultural exchange or not?
I think it's about enhancing, you know, Hong Kong's own soft power as well, definitely, because I know I'm definitely a firm believer of Hong Kong's, you know, art talent. You know, we have got quite really professional curators, and, you know, we can offer new...
Sure, but this is, we're talking about the five-year plan now, aren't we? So obviously the mainland, the nation as a whole is under consideration, and is that the aim? Is it to, or one of the aims to improve, enhance China's soft power? Would you say?
As a result, I think yes.
Well, I think it is definitely, it will enhance the soft power. But then, you know, Hong Kong, yeah, we're still operating under one country, two systems. And I'm just thinking, you know, what our next generation could, make use of that and to create work, with some freedom of expression and not just to... Do art and tech, but I think tech is only a means of expressing, and the content is actually still the most important.
For sure, yeah.
Would you see this happening, Helen?
I definitely think I definitely think we shouldn't be distracted by the tech gimmick or the tool of using technology to kind of communicate. I definitely think the focus should definitely be on developing, quality content. And it should be, we need to build our kind of soft power. We need to know our cultural content in order to, enhance our own city's cultural soft power going forward.
Okay. Well, Helen, many thanks for joining us, Lead Arts and Culture with the Our Hong Kong Foundation. Many thanks to David Webb, and once again, founder and editor of website.com. Excuse me. And Mark Michelson, chairman of the Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia. Thank you very much indeed. Once again, Mark, some...